Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Very wealthy drug company executives are being found guilty of bribing doctors to prescribe a dangerous painkiller to patients who did not need it. Today's guest, Chris McGrill, reports that the convictions will spur demands for executives of other opioid makers to be held accountable for an epidemic that has claimed 400,000 lives over the past two decades in the United States. The United States consumes more than 80% of the world's opioid painkillers. People living in this country, obviously, yet the U.S. accounts for less than 5% of the world's population. So how did this happen? Joining us in a couple minutes is Chris McGrill. He writes for The Guardian. He's a former Guardian correspondent in Washington, Johannesburg, and Jerusalem. Chris is author of The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts, which focuses on how Purdue's OxyContin, the most powerful narcotic painkiller, has devastated poor communities in central Appalachia. But as Chris reports, this is about so much more than Purdue. Hi, Chris. Welcome back to the show.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for joining us, Chris. You know, as you know, since you've been a longtime journalist, there's just so much going on right now. And I just want to go over a couple of basic statistics, just to show how deep this crisis continues to be. And these numbers are from the American Physical Therapy Association. In 2016, healthcare providers across the U.S. wrote more than 214 million prescriptions for opioid pain medication. As many as one in five receive prescription opioids long-term for non-cancer pain. Every day, more than 1,000 people are treated in emergency departments for misusing prescription opioids. Chris, what other statistics would you say are important? And then we'll dive in and talk about how this is affecting people on the ground.
Yes, well, I just mentioned on that statistic from 2016, there is good news on that front in the sense that the latest stats show that actually prescribing fell quite sharply last year. And it's probably about 30 to 40% down from its peak in 2012 when 255 million prescriptions were written for opioids, which was essentially enough to give every American adult 30 days worth of pills. So it has fallen, and it is falling, but it still remains much higher than in almost any other developed country. Well, not almost, in any other developed country. So, and particularly compared to, say, countries like France or Germany. But the other statistics which really leap out, I think, from this epidemic. Firstly, one of the reasons I wanted to write the book was because it is a uniquely American epidemic. The prescribing levels just alone tell you a story. But the numbers of deaths, although, again, they have fallen slightly, overdose deaths for prescription drugs, they continue to increase for illicit opioids, particularly fentanyl. There were about 60,000 deaths last year from opioid overdoses. About half of those were fentanyl, which is an illegally produced opioid, synthetic opioid, that's often mixed in with other drugs, either fake prescription pills or with heroin. That accounted for about 30,000 deaths. Another 15,000 deaths from heroin alone, and about another 15,000 from prescription opioids. And those numbers have just gone on rising quite sharply, particularly with the illicit drugs. And that's really shocking. But there are also statistics on the ground which really give you an idea of the impact of this epidemic. I mean, there's 2 to 3 million people who are dependent on opioids. So it's not just the people who die. Mm. It's families are wrecked, lives are wrecked by dependency. And if you go to look at states like West Virginia, you see a huge rise in the number of children taken into care, so much so that West Virginia actually has to send some children out of state because it doesn't have the facilities to look after them.
Wow.
You see, again, in places like West Virginia, Eastern Kentucky, but some other places, I used to report from Africa during the 1990s, and you would go to villages in Uganda where you would see grandparents bringing up their grandchildren because of AIDS. There was a missing generation that had died of AIDS. And I wouldn't want to overstate this, but you get some of that in parts of West Virginia, where you see that the grandparents are raising the grandchildren. You go to towns where they have meetings to help the grandparents with this. The parents are perhaps dead, perhaps simply unable through addiction to raise their children, perhaps in prison. But a lot of children are now being cared for by their grandparents in parts of the country because of that. So you see a lot of different impacts from this epidemic.
Wow. You know, I was just struck by what you said, Chris, that children in West Virginia are being sent to other states because there's not enough people to adopt them and take care of them?
Yes, or alternatively, there's not enough state facilities to actually take them into the care of the state.
Wow. What have you talked? I mean, your book is so extensive. You interviewed so many people. Can you talk about just how these children are coping with this?
Well, I think one of the things that really worries social workers and people that care for these children is that they aren't really able to cope with this very well. A couple of things could happen, and we're just, because this epidemic's gone on for so long, and that was one of the reasons I wanted to write the book, is how is it that this epidemic began when Bill Clinton was in the White House, and it ran all the way through George W. Bush's presidency into Barack Obama's, and it was only in the last year of Barack Obama's tenure that we heard a president stand up and speak about this publicly. And because it's gone on for so long, we're now starting to see a generation of children who've been orphaned by this epidemic becoming young adults and adults. And one of the things that worries social workers is that those children have seen their parents overdose, or they've grown up in houses where drugs were very prevalent. And they are starting to see signs that some of these children, not the only ones, not all of them by any means, but some of them, see the use of drugs as a kind of normalized way of dealing with the trauma in their lives. Mm. And so it's passed on to the next generation. Now, this isn't unique to opioids. We've seen this with other forms of addiction passed from generation to generation. But they obviously find this particularly worrying with opioids because of the surge in accessibility and the surge in overdoses and death. I mean, alongside that, you have the other issue, which involves children, which is babies who are born in withdrawal. Mm. And that obviously is extremely traumatic for them. And in fact, West Virginia, the town of Huntington, the city of Huntington, has a somewhere called Lily's Place, which was the first sort of independent facility for helping babies who were born in withdrawal from opioids. And that, as the nurses there describe it, is extremely traumatic for the children and for the nurses, because they see these babies who spend weeks and sometimes months battling the appalling effects of opioid withdrawal, which is extremely painful for them, but also extremely distressing for, to have to see this in a child.
Wow. Chris, everyone has a story, and you've written profiles in your book. You wrote a new piece in late April called "I Don't Want to Overdose and Die, One Woman's Death, One Country's Shame." You write, Sage Early, who was found dead of a heroin overdose in a toilet stall at Syracuse Airport, is the face of real people devastated by the worst drug epidemic in American history. Can you put some faces to these names? I mean, given that you have spent so much time reporting on this issue, what would you say is, I don't mean to use the word trend here, but what stands out the most when you talk to people about what happened to them and their loved ones and how they got addicted to these drugs?
Well, I think it evolved. I think that, and it spread across the country and it hit different communities in different ways. I mean, if we look at the kind of crucible of it around that part of Appalachia, around West Virginia, eastern Kentucky, southern Ohio, what you see there in its origins is areas that were targeted by the very powerful mass marketing of high-strength opioids. And the reason that drug companies went into those areas to sell the pills was that people in those parts of the world were frequently using pain medication anyway, because you had very high levels of people in manual labor. One of the interesting bits of demography about this epidemic is that for the first decade or so, the people who were most likely to be overdose and die were actually middle-aged people between the ages of 45 and 54. That was the highest rate of overdose. And one of the reasons for that is that you have those are the people that are battling the consequences of working down the mines or the coal mines or working, in timber mills or wherever. So I'll give you a very good example of a man I spoke to called Willis Duncan. And Willis had been an electrician on the coal mines, and he'd taken low-level painkillers for years, as miners had. They used all kinds of medication way back when. They used moonshine and then marijuana. And as opioid pills made their way in, because they were prescription drugs, a lot of people using them thought that they were safe, and they would get their prescriptions, and to begin with, they were relatively low-level strength, so they created a kind of dependence amongst people in these communities, but they weren't really at risk of overdosing unless they did a lot of drugs. But there was that dependency, and then Willis has an accident on the mine, and he gets prescribed much more powerful drugs. OxyContin was one of them. And then he becomes seriously addicted. And after that, they take over his life. He cannot get up and go to work unless he's got drugs. And initially, he's able to get them from doctors. He's able to get them on prescription. But as his tolerance builds up, he can't get them in the quantities he needs. So he starts buying them illegally from pill mills, which were essentially doctors just writing prescriptions for anybody who wanted them, or buying them on the black market. And in the midst of this, Willis's wife, Debbie, has a hysterectomy, and she is prescribed high-strength opioids, and she becomes addicted. And so they're both using these drugs a lot. And then his son, who also works on the mine, starts using these drugs to essentially medicate, but also as a form of entertainment. And the three of them in this family are using vast quantities of opioids that they're actually mostly able to get from doctors, but not always. Sometimes they buy on the black market. And it just takes over their lives, so much so that Willis describes Debbie, who was the most addicted. He would get home, and he would find her kind of stuck in a position like a robot who just stopped moving because she had taken such a large amount of opioids. And eventually, Debbie dies of an overdose, and then a year or so later, his son dies as well. And even then, Willis can't get off these drugs. He's so addicted to them. And finally, it came down to the fact he simply couldn't afford it anymore. He was spending almost all of the money he earned on the mines when he was working, buying drugs. And you know, that is a picture you hear of a lot across that part of the world, which was definitely targeted for sales. The drugs then spread across the country in different ways, but principally because the medical industry, the pharmaceutical companies, essentially got hold of medical policy. Mm-hmm. And they did it through a mix of front organizations, but pushing the idea that these drugs were the magic bullet for pain, and that they could be prescribed very widely and safely for all kinds of pain. So much so that you see the rise of the idea of pain as the fifth vital sign. And that's the idea that you go to a doctor, you get your vital signs checked, like your heart rate and your blood pressure, and that pain can somehow also be measured and treated in the same way. Of course, it can't, but because it's entirely subjective, there's no way of measuring pain. But this idea was pushed into hospitals, it was pushed into doctors' clinics, and it took hold. And so much so that the medical profession came under enormous pressure to prescribe these drugs. Even doctors, even if they didn't want to, they came under pressure from insurance companies because it's a cheap way of treating people. They came under pressure from the patients themselves who wanted these drugs. And you see that culture take hold so that opioids become the default. And the promise that you can live free of pain, and just so long as you go on taking more and more of these pills. And one of the myths that took hold that was based on no science whatsoever, but was offered up as though it was scientific fact, was that you could increase the dosage to meet the pain levels without risk of addiction. And that wasn't true, but what doctors did was, if people said they were in pain still, they just gave them more drugs. Mm.
Today we're speaking with Chris McGreal. He is a writer for The Guardian and author of The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts. And it focuses on how opioids have devastated poor communities in central Appalachia. Of course, Purdue's OxyContin tends to get the most attention. And Chris went in depth about Purdue in his book. But he also points out that we should not pin the opioid crisis just on Purdue because the guilt runs wide. And if you have any questions for Chris about the opioid crisis, if you have been affected by this, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call, 866-798-8255. What do you think about the media coverage of this? As Chris said, OxyContin came to market during the Clinton administration, and the opioid crisis finally started getting a lot of attention just a couple of years ago. So what are your thoughts on the media coverage of this crisis? And now that we see that high-level, very wealthy executives are being found guilty of bribing doctors, well, the big question is, what's next? 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Well, Chris, you wrote a piece in March for The Guardian called Don't Pin the Opioid Crisis Just on Purdue. The guilt runs wide. But let's spend a little bit of time talking about Purdue. You have written extensively about them in your book. And the Sackler family has gotten a lot more attention. A number of artists are protesting inside of museums because the Sacklers have given a number of high-profile museums millions of dollars. According to Bloomberg, court filings say that OxyContin earned the Sackler family more than $4 billion, billion with a B, from 2008 to 2015. So what do we need to know about Purdue and all of them? There's so many lawsuits that have been filed now against this company.
Yes, and that $4 billion, the date 2008 to 2012, is just a small part of the epidemic. You have the billions that they made, at least another $4 billion up until 2008. I mean, they probably made 8, 10, maybe more than that billion out of this. And I think the thing to know about the behavior of Purdue Pharma is that clearly it widened and drove this epidemic, not only by unleashing OxyContin onto the market, which was a very powerful drug. And the thing to know about OxyContin is that there were other opioids on the market, but they were weaker, and you took them every 3 or 4 hours. And OxyContin was brought onto the market essentially as a marketing exercise. It came with the promise that it was stronger but safer and more effective. And the Purdue Pharma made this argument, saying that they had created a very high-strength drug, but the way addiction works, or one of the ways you can become addicted, is that when you take a prescription opioid pill, it gives you an instant hit before slowly tapering off. And the more frequently you get that hit, the more likely it is that it will create addiction. And if you're taking a pill every 3 or 4 hours, Purdue said there was a much greater risk of addiction. By creating a higher dosage pill that you could take every 12 hours, you'd take one every 12 hours, so two a day as opposed to, say, eight a day, the risk of addiction was lowered, they said. You didn't get the hit. It bled the drug into your system at a much slower rate. And therefore was more effective. And because it lasted for 12 hours, it was a better drug because you didn't have to wake up in the night to take it. Now, none of that was true. The first thing is that, in fact, it did give you exactly the same hit. It did work in the same way that you got an instant boost, but you got a much larger instant boost than you would have because it was a much stronger drug than the lower-level opioids available. And the other thing was that frequently it didn't last for 12 hours. In fact, it lasted only for about 8 or 9, which meant that people were taking the drug more frequently than they should have. So overall, they're getting much higher dosages than they were supposed to be getting. And that was just two of the problems with it. And what's important in all of that is that in making their claims that this drug was more effective and that it was safer, Purdue Pharma was able to persuade the Food and Drug Administration, which essentially approves how a drug is allowed onto the market, of this. And so it went on to the what's known as the label. It went on to the conditions for this drug. And then Purdue Pharma turned around and said, well, the FDA says this about our drug. This is an independent assessment of it, which wasn't true. It was just, FDA was simply repeating what Purdue Pharma said. And then it sent its sales reps out to claim all these things for this drug, whilst at the same time claiming that this is what the FDA said about it. So you see a huge marketing push to get OxyContin out there. And we now know from the various legal actions that at the center of that was Dr. Richard Sackler, who would become CEO and president of the company, was also head of marketing early on. And he has revealed in emails at the time to say, we're going to create a blizzard of prescriptions for OxyContin to blow the competition out of the water, that we're, you know, going to make this the go-to drug. Everybody's going to use it. And it was clearly not based on the medical benefits. It was simply based on how many drugs can they sell and how much profit they can make. And that's really where you see the epidemic take off. But it wasn't just that the company unleashed a marketing campaign. And as very effective it was. They found the doctors that were already prescribing opioids, lower-level opioids, and targeted them. They found the areas, like I was just saying, West Virginia, that these drugs were already being used, and targeted those. But they also set about changing the medical culture. And it's a bit of what I was saying earlier about getting doctors to prescribe, pressuring hospitals, the pain as a fifth vital sign. Purdue Pharma was a driving force, not the only one, behind that. They had enormous influence. They put a lot of money into pushing prescribing, and they did something more than that. They entered into effectively business relationships with the institutions that are supposed to govern this. I'll give you the example of something called the Joint Commission, which licenses hospitals in this country. And Purdue Pharma, along with various other organizations in the same business, got the Joint Commission on board to require hospitals to treat pain as a fifth vital sign and to get doctors to prescribe opioids as the default patient default treatment. And part of the benefit for the Joint Commission in doing that was that Purdue Pharma wrote all the manuals and the training guides for the doctors on these drugs and then gave them to the Joint Commission and allowed them to sell the manuals to the hospitals and the doctors and make quite a lot of money out of doing that. So it became a business relationship as well as a medical one.
Today we're speaking with Chris McGreal. After the break, we will talk about these lawsuits. Purdue and its billionaire owners have been named individually in more than 200 suits. And just a couple of months ago, actually in March, Purdue and the Sacklers reached a $270 million settlement in an opioid lawsuit. They negotiated this with the state of Oklahoma, which allowed them to avoid a high-profile televised courtroom trial. So we will also talk about these settlements. Chris McGreal is author of American Overdose, The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW. There are many ways you can take part in the conversation on today's show. On the phone, by sending an email to yourcall@klw.org, or by calling 866-798-8255. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio. A very good morning to you. I'm David LaTulip, and I'm turning things over to producer of Your Call, Malihe Razazan, for a way to support KLW.
David, and I'm joined in studio by James Anderson, a member of our development team. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning.
And we're going to take a very short break to ask for your support. Your call depends on your contributions, small or large, to stay independent. With media under attack, if you believe in independent media as a critical part of our ecosystem, and if you appreciate the work of our small team at Your Call, please do give us a call. I'm at 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or go to klw.org. And we are offering as a gift American Overdose, The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts by our guest, Chris McGreal.
Yes, and actually we have a very good piece of news here. We have two of our donors who believe enough in the work that we are doing here with Your Call and with KALW in general. We'd like to thank Paul Sack and Shirley Ross Davis, who have put up a very generous challenge of $1,000 to help inspire you to support this station. So we're looking for 10 calls or clicks during your call in order to fulfill this challenge. So please take Paul and Shirley up on the offer and make that call right now to 800-525-9917 or visit us at KALW.org.
1-800-525-9917. As a thank you gift, we will send you American Overdose, The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts by our guest, Chris McGreal, for a pledge of $120. Thank you so much.
This is Your Call's Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. And today we are speaking with journalist Chris McGreal. He writes for The Guardian. He's former Guardian correspondent in Washington, Johannesburg, and Jerusalem. Chris is author of American Overdose, The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts. He has been writing about cases against drug company executives. In fact, many have been found guilty. He's been writing about this ongoing crisis and poverty in the United States. And if you have any questions for Chris, if you'd like to talk about media coverage of this, how do you think the media are covering these billion-dollar corporations? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall at kalw.org. Chris, let's spend some time talking about the lawsuits against Purdue and this $270 million settlement that was just announced in March. This is a settlement with the state of Oklahoma, and it allows Purdue to avoid a highly publicized, televised courtroom trial.
It does indeed. And in fact, Purdue have been attempting to avoid that for years now. I think that some of the revelations that have come out in the lawsuits filed in states such as New York and Massachusetts are exactly what Purdue Pharma do not want to be talking about in public, which is essentially they knew how dangerous this drug was, their drug was OxyContin, and they kept on pushing it. And part of the revelation is just how cynical they were about it. Dr. Richard Sackler, part of the family that owns Purdue Pharma, but also he was head of marketing and heavily involved in the administration of the company at the height of OxyContin. The emails revealed his cynicism, really, about those people who became addicted. He simply describes them as criminals who do not deserve our sympathy. And what he essentially does is paint them as the problem. He blames the people, the patient, not the pill, for people becoming addicted. And in fact, this isn't just him doing this. This becomes an industry-wide strategy through the 2000s as addiction and deaths rise. The industry sets about essentially claiming to the medical profession and to Congress and anybody else who's paying attention to this that that there are these what they describe as drug abusers who are getting hooked on these drugs and that they're to blame for their own addiction and that the people who really need these drugs should not be deprived of them. The good patients, the innocent patients, should not be deprived of them because of the people they characterize as drug abusers. Of course, what that ignores, what Richard Sackler ignored and what that strategy ignored by the wider pharmaceutical industry is, of course, that many people who became addicted and then died actually became addicted through following their prescriptions because the doctors were being told these drugs were safe, and so the patients were not being warned of the danger.
So what do you think about these settlements? Because if we're talking about a company that has made $8 billion in profits since 2000, or since, as you said, before 2000, $270 million is not that much. So do you expect that Purdue will just settle because they're so incredibly profitable? And then from a legal perspective, can a legislator or a politician or a lawyer, I mean, how does that work if someone says, you know what, we're not going to settle with you, we are going to take this to court?
Well, I think there are a couple of things at work here, one of which is, so the settlement, which, as you say, isn't that large, but it was just with Oklahoma.
Right.
Now, there's a separate case going on, which brings together more than 1,300 cases. It's a kind of nationwide case in Ohio. And that is states and cities and counties across the country who are suing not only Purdue Pharma, but other opioid manufacturers, and crucially, the drug distributors who delivered these pills, and in doing so, frequently did not obey the law, and have themselves paid out huge amounts of money, hundreds of millions, to deal with that. And they're crucial to this, because if you take, well, I was just telling you earlier about Willis Duncan. Now, Willis Duncan lived in Mingo County, which is this little county in the southwest of West Virginia. And those drug distributors delivered 20 million pills to this county in over a period of a decade, or a bit less than that. And they did so without fulfilling any of their legal obligations to see whether these were legitimate deliveries. So you've got these lawsuits that they're working their way through. Now, particularly with the Ohio one, I've spoken to the lawyers that are running that case, and they are talking about settlement to match the big tobacco settlement. They're saying that, you know, big tobacco settled, I think, for about $250 billion, mm-hmm. Several years ago, and they want to see that kind of settlement, because they firstly say it's required to be able to provide the resources for these places that have been hit in order to deal with treatment, to deal with the legacy, you know, the children, the crime, all of that, but also to stop businesses just viewing paying fines, civil settlements, and keeping everything sealed as the cost of doing business and then carrying on as before. Now, if there were a settlement in the billions, that may well be the end of Purdue Pharma. It's not making money out of OxyContin anymore, really, certainly not on the same scale. And it did earlier this year explore bankruptcy, although that might have just been a feign to try and negotiate a lower settlement. But it does seem that they're determined on a very, very, very large settlement, which will have a real impact financially on these companies. But there's also something else at work here now, is that there are a lot of people whose families have been affected by this, you know, politicians who run towns, like the mayor of Huntington, West Virginia, which at one point had the highest overdose rate in the country. They want to see these executives held criminally responsible. Mm. They don't want them to just buy their way out and carry on and keep the tens of millions that they've been paying themselves selling these drugs. And so they're pressing for prosecution. And the bad news for those executives is that actually earlier this month, we saw five executives from a company called Inzis that was, they were convicted of racketeering over the illegal promotion, essentially bribing doctors to prescribe a high-strength spray made of fentanyl. And including John Kapoor, who was the founder of the company. Those are the first real criminal convictions in this epidemic, and I think they will be closely looked at, that a jury was prepared to convict all of the executives who'd been illegally promoting this drug. And I think there must be some very worried executives from some of these other drug companies now who will be wondering whether criminal prosecutions are coming down the line.
So, Chris, do you think that any of these executives will end up in jail?
Well, I think the five executives from Insys are very likely to end up in jail. I mean, they face up to 20 years in prison each. It's racketeering. There were serious charges. So I would be surprised if they didn't go to jail. Whether others will go remains to be seen. I mean, the Purdue Pharma was actually convicted in 2007 of illegally marketing OxyContin. And it was able to, through political pressure in some ways, keep its executives out of jail. They were convicted on misdemeanors in order that they didn't go to prison. But they were convicted. They did plead guilty to illegally marketing the drug. And one of the reasons they're still being pursued is that they just went on doing the same thing, not the individuals who then left the company, but the company itself. So there was a precedent in 2007, but the power of the pharmaceutical industry and its influence over the federal authorities was such that they were able to prevent the executives actually going to prison. And I think that's part of the story we see throughout the past 20 years is, you know, one of the reasons this has gone on so long is that that drug company money, drug company lobbying has co-opted in many ways some federal regulators like the Food and Drug Administration, which allowed these drugs to continue to be prescribed in the way that they're being prescribed, parts of the medical profession, but also the politicians, into not doing anything until we reach the point we've now reached.
You mentioned John Kapoor. He's a 75-year-old billionaire. According to Forbes, his net worth is $1.8 billion. He's the founder of Insys Therapeutics. He's been found guilty of defrauding insurance companies in the push to sell Subsys, a spray made from fentanyl, as you said, a synthetic opioid many times stronger than morphine. And you wrote in your Guardian piece about this, Chris, that Subsys was approved for terminal cancer patients, but the company targeted sales at a much bigger and more profitable market of people with non-life-threatening chronic pain. Prosecutors said that fueled the opioid epidemic and cost lives. So Insys Therapeutics, I'm guessing that people who have never heard of Subsys have probably never heard of Insys Therapeutics. As you say in another piece, Purdue may have kicked open the door to this crisis, but the epidemic escalated over the past two decades because the medical industry in control of this country's healthcare system made it happen. How many companies would you say are like Insys Therapeutics that many of us have never heard of?
Oh, I think the vast majority we've heard of Purdue Pharma because of the scandal now. When I was talking about the drug distributor, one of them, McKesson Health, is the fifth largest company in the country. And I don't think that most people will have heard of McKesson or Cardinal or any of the other drug distributors. These are very big companies that have huge turnovers and huge profits, but they're not really on people's radar. When Purdue settled with Oklahoma, Oklahoma is continuing the case against some other companies, and one of them actually most people would have heard of, but not in the context of these kinds of drugs, and that's Johnson & Johnson, which makes baby oil and things. So sometimes they've heard of them, but again, not in the context of the opioid epidemic. But that Insys, I mean, what is interesting perhaps about the Insys conviction is that those actions that he was convicted of, the racketeering, the bribing of the doctors, the pushing of the drug for much wider than cancer treatment, that was in very recent years, since 2012, when the drug came onto the market. What you see with, say, OxyContin in particular, from 20 years ago, that's exactly what they did with Purdue Pharma did with that drug, is that actually, very high-strength opioids have traditionally been used to treat people who had terminal cancer pain. And Purdue Pharma looked at that and said, well, why are we just giving it to them? They're a small market, and they're a market that essentially is limited in the sense that the patient dies. If we can get people living with chronic pain, so they're not dying of their pain, they will be buying it. You know, they're basically customers for life. And that's what they aimed at. So Insys, in a sense, was only following the path already forged by Purdue Pharma.
You mentioned McKesson, which is based here in San Francisco. So this is a drug distributor. We've talked about them a few times on the show. You report that they have agreed to pay West Virginia $37 million to settle a lawsuit over flooding the state with millions of opioid pills without abiding by proper controls. Again, this is a drop in the bucket. I'm looking at McKesson's fiscal report on their own website. This came out in January. They say revenues of $56 billion for the third quarter, up 5% year over year. $56 billion in revenues in the third quarter. They also paid $150 million to settle a federal investigation a couple of years ago. What do you think is next for a drug distributor like McKesson? And what is their business practice today, given what's happening right now?
Well, they clearly, partly because there is now this incredible focus politically and by prosecutors and others on them, they have very much more restricted how and controlled how they deliver these drugs. But I think one of the reasons that they're doing that is that they, for so long, got away with not doing it. And that $150 million settlement is very interesting and revealing because That came out of a Drug Enforcement Administration investigation. There's a part of the DEA which oversees the distribution of legal drugs. It requires, the law requires, that companies such as McKesson, when they deliver very large numbers of prescription pills to a place, that they verify that that is a legitimate delivery to a pharmacy. And the idea is that if they see, as happened, for instance, in a tiny town like Kermit, West Virginia, that a pharmacy goes from ordering a few hundred pills a month to 8,000 a day, then that ought to ring alarm bells. And what the law requires is that a company like McKesson, the delivery company, it informs the Drug Enforcement Administration, but also suspends delivery. And basically, McKesson and Cardinal and the other companies spent more than a decade not doing that. And when the DEA called them up on it, the DEA has an enforcement division, and it used to be headed by a man called Joe Ranasisi. And I talked to Ranasisi in the book, and he tells me how, you know, he would call up these companies, he would call them in, and he would tell them, listen, you're not doing your due diligence. You need to check. These drugs are not going to where they should go. They would simply nod their heads, say yes, and then they would file a few reports saying this looks dodgy and then go back to their old way. And he said it didn't matter. You could fine them. You could come to a settlement. They would just pay it and they would just carry on. And he said, and when he tried to move towards criminal prosecution, they used their influence with the Department of Justice. They used their influence in Washington to head him off, essentially, to try and prevent him from going after him. And when he finally manages to move against these companies in Florida and also the pharmacies themselves, like CVS, which are dispensing very large numbers of pills, they go to Washington and get the law changed to take that power away from the DEA. And for many, many years, these drug distributors knew exactly what was going on, and they kept the doors open. It wasn't like they failed to understand that. One of the arguments that's been put forward by the drug companies is they're just the delivery mechanism. How are they supposed to know? It's not their job to police. But as Ranasisi said to me, well, if they're just delivery, why don't we use FedEx? The fact is that these drug companies make huge amounts of money, these drug distribution companies, from delivering narcotic pills because they have a special license to do it. But that requires special obligations, and they fail to fulfill those obligations.
Today we're speaking with Chris McGreal about American Overdose, the opioid tragedy in three acts. Chris is a writer for The Guardian U.S. Chris, we have about 5 minutes left. Since you brought up lobbying, CNN had a piece in January, and it found that the lobbying group for the pharmaceutical industry called Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America spent $27.5 million on lobbying last year, and they represent some of the largest drug and bioresearch companies. Again, it's a drop in the bucket given their huge profits. I also want to ask you what you think about media coverage of this issue in the national media, especially on the cable shows, because the United States and New Zealand are the only countries in the world that allow drug companies to advertise on television. This happened in the United States under the Clinton administration when they deregulated pharmaceutical ads on television. And according to a couple different websites, last year, pharma television ads soared to almost $4 billion. So $4 billion. The media, these media companies, you know, MSNBC, Comcast, CBS, Disney, they're making a lot of money from big pharma ads. How do you think that affects their coverage of this issue?
I don't know if it does. I mean, I think that the media coverage, one of the things when you look at media coverage of this epidemic is actually when it began in the late 90s and early 2000s, there's a lot of very, very good coverage, and particularly local coverage in newspapers in places like Kentucky and West Virginia, who write about the rise of OxyContin, write about what it's doing to these communities. The New York Times, Barry Mayer, a reporter for the New York Times, did some excellent work exposing Purdue and OxyContin. And then it falls off through the 2000s, and then essentially it disappears, perhaps because it's perceived that not much is changing, but also because of the power of that lobbying that you're talking about. The drug companies, when they became alarmed at the news coverage and at the idea that maybe their drugs were going to be blamed for this rising epidemic, they went in to change the conversation, and essentially they, particularly with Congress, they said nothing should be done that would take away the pills from the people that need them, that there has to be a, quote, balanced approach. And that meant keeping the door wide open to prescribing to anybody who wanted these drugs. And they created a situation where they claimed that there were 100 million Americans, one in three of the country, that actually needed opioids, which is a completely overblown and false claim. But they pushed this idea. And that was the power of lobbying. It had a real impact. It wasn't the only impact, but that change in the conversation was one of them. But I think, you know, there are many, many things that have fed into this epidemic, and I think that the advertising of pills is part of it. Not because opioids were actually advertised very much on television. They weren't. But there was a kind of conditioning that's been going on over the years, and doctors talk to you about this, and they say that advertising is one part of it, but the rise of what's known as the pill for every ill mentality in the United States, that people go to the doctor and they expect to be given tablets, mm-hmm. medicine for whatever the condition is. They don't necessarily want to hear that they need to diet or exercise or change their lifestyle to deal with whatever the condition is. They just need to pop a pill. And the huge rise in advertising of drugs has, I think, helped to condition people to the idea that you just go and get a prescription. And that's certainly fed into the demand for opioids, but also the idea that opioids were completely safe, because nobody, as I say, was warning the patient that actually these were very dangerous and highly addictive drugs.
Well, Chris, as always, thank you so much for your work. Just quickly, in 30 seconds, and we'll have to have you on again, what do you think will come, given that some executives are now being found guilty of bribing doctors? What's next?
I think there are two things. I think that there will be some accountability, and I think the mood is such that there is a press for more prosecutions. I think it's going to be hard for the drug companies to just buy their way out of this one now, although I think some will try and some may succeed. But those who are most responsible, I think there is a reckoning coming, and it will be interesting to see where these lawsuits go through this year when they start to come to a head. But I also think, you know, with the shift, with the growth of fentanyl deaths and overdoses and heroin deaths, and with prescription pills still out there, I think we're a long way from the end of this epidemic. I think the rising numbers of death, even if they level off and start to fall before it's all over, I think we will perhaps see as many people die as have already died. And we're up to around 400,000 deaths from this opioid epidemic over the past 20 years already.
Wow. Well, Chris, thank you so much for your excellent reporting, and we'd love to have you back. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Chris McGrill is a writer for The Guardian US and author of American Overdose, The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thank you for joining us.